What's up, gold miners? In today's episode, we welcome to the show Cameron Pym, a principal at Stonemark Landings, a value-add multifamily investment group located in Las Vegas. And Cameron and I geek out a little bit at the beginning. And then right after geeking out a little bit, we dive right into Cameron's practices in managing investor expectations through conservative underwriting practices, as well as hands-on management. What all does that entail? Well, Cameron breaks it down for us step by step. No stone is left unturned in the details in this episode. Later on in the episode, Cameron shares what to look for as an investor in the different areas that you're potentially going to be investing in. And then finally, Cameron covers what he expects to see in 2024 and how he is positioning his company to capture the potential upcoming opportunities. Cameron brings a wealth of knowledge, experience, and wisdom to this episode. So without further ado, everyone, let's welcome to the show, Cameron Pym. Cameron, welcome to the Gold Mine.
Thank you, Danny. Happy to be here. Appreciate the invite.
Absolutely, man. Well, you know, I've been seeing some of the stuff online. Obviously, you've been on some shows. I had a chance to look at your LinkedIn and kind of get caught up. So it looks like, A, you've been doing this for a long time. B, it looks like you've had quite the path into what you're doing right now. And so I'd love for you to kind of take us on the journey, you know, where it all began and how you got to where you are today. Because obviously, like, one doesn't get to where you are without, a lot of steps. So I'd love to hear the journey for myself and for everyone back out.
Sure. My real estate journey started working with local investors and developers in Atlanta. Really got a great education. I'd say a master's or PhD from the leaders in those local industries. Yeah. Learned the ins and outs of how they structured deals, how they operated them post-closing. And, you know, in working with them, I started thinking, well, you know, I understand this. I think I can go out and put some deals together of my own and make them work. And so I started doing that. And it was, it was like pushing a boulder up a hill for a long time, trying to get your first deal done. That was just, it took years. And finally, we got our first deal done. We had a single investor. The deal went well. We exited within a year, turned that into our next deal that had two investors, turned that in about a year and a half. And it snowballed from there as you know, communicating to my network of the successes we were having, not only with my day job, but with these investments. And, you know, what was interesting is everybody wants to invest in real estate because they've been told it is such a safe place for your money. It's the best place to invest. But most of them don't want the headache of dealing with actually owning the asset or being the landlord themselves. The late night calls, you know, along the line of late night calls, even as a more professional and established shop now, we all know that the issues that are coming up are not coming up 9 to 5 when you have on-site staff. The issues come up after everybody's gone home for the evening or the weekend, and those are the calls where you're trying to bring your team in on-call staff to resolve the issues. So, you know, we took that on for our friends and family and then scaled that up into... The next step was working with some family offices and local family offices, and then doing joint ventures with some local groups that were established. And, we had great success, continued success. One of the secrets to that, I think, was one, under-promising on returns and expectations, having enough that people are excited to invest and want to do it.
Yeah.
But then exceeding their expectations so that you are the positive topic of conversation at dinner or cocktail parties. And so, you know, we've certainly done that. Yeah. We're very proud that we've never lost investor money. And I think that goes to our conservative underwriting nature, as well as our hands-on asset management approach.
So let's just dive right into it. You know, when you talk about conservative underwriting, because here's the thing, right? Like, dude, I can't tell you how many times I've heard that, right? It's like, oh, we have a conservative underwriting and like we're super hands-on. Everyone says that. Let's talk details here, right? So conservative underwriting, what is it about your underwriting or what do you do specifically when you're analyzing these properties to hedge and to create a conservative output?
Yeah, you know, there's a number of inputs to a pro forma that drastically influence the outcome of an investment. It's your purchase price. It's your cost of CapEx. It's the time frame it takes to do CapEx. It's your projected stabilized rents, your OpEx, and then your exit cap. And so within all of those inputs, we can influence pretty much all of those with the exception of your exit cap. Uh-huh. And so what we want to do is pad those that we have control over and even pad the exit cap, which I'll talk about in a second. But for example, if I think that our stabilized renovated rents are $1,500 a month, I'm probably going to model $1,400. On the CapEx side of things, we're going to take the highest bid. We're also going to add a contingency to it. And then we're also going to add time to the timeline that was proposed or in the bid. Because when has a construction project ever actually delivered on time, right? And yeah. So your delivery of things, how long it takes, how long you're floating in construction debt, all of those things have a significant impact into available cash and the success of your project. And then as you're looking at your liquidity event, whether that's the plan is to refinance or to sell, that exit cap is a huge influence on the success of a deal. 100%. And so we typically like to underwrite for the worst case scenario and show an expansion in cap rate, even if, for example, nowadays, maybe cap rates come down if interest rates come down, but I still think it's prudent to show that an expanding cap rate. And if it doesn't, and the deal still works, and cap rates are either at stay the same or compress, you've really done well, and your investors are going to be very happy. You've hit a home run on that one.
Right.
But, the reality is that nothing ever goes to plan, particularly with real estate and value add real estate at that. So having all of these conservative estimates in place kind of give you a margin of error that allows you to still achieve your modeled returns.
So when we talk about conservative underwriting, we talk about like the projections that you're, and by the way, I totally agree, like especially on the exit cap, I mean, that can make or break a deal, right? Like you underwrite too aggressively there, and all of a sudden, you you're losing money, right? So, because that's...
Yeah, exactly. You're writing a check to get out of the deal.
Yeah. So with the conservative underwriting, are you basing your LPIRR off of the conservative underwriting models, or are you using like a blend of like conservative and like best case scenario? Or what are you using the conservative model for? Is it mostly to hedge and make sure like, hey, if shit really hits the fan, are we still like in the green? Is it like for that, or is it to like kind of walk me through what the thought process is there?
Yeah, there's certainly that. What's the worst case scenario that, what are your break even scenarios? And we have sensitivities built into our model between occupancy, cap rates, et cetera. But what we are showing investors is a conservative estimate of what we think. Really, we think it's going to be, call it a project level IRR of 25%. But what we're showing our investors, and we know that it'll still hit their return criteria, is probably a 20 to 22 project level IRR. And so that creates an added cushion for things to go wrong, whether they are within or out of our control.
Yeah, that makes sense. So that's really high level stuff, right? So there might be someone that's like sitting back at home and like, what is going on here? What are they talking about? Well, this is what happens when you get two guys that enjoy this shit, and we're going to nerd out for a little bit here. All right. Me and you, Cam, we're going to have some fun today.
That's right. I love it.
And we'll keep it high level. So I'm curious, right? Because I know that like your target asset class right now, and correct me if I'm wrong, by the way, but the target investment that you're looking for is some sort of distressed multifamily that you can reposition in the marketplace. Yeah,
that's right. And in the past, what it's been has been a, maybe it's a C to B minus asset that we can reposition to a B plus with an eye towards what we call working class achievable. A lot of others may just call that workforce housing, but really, we're serving the backbones of our community, those that are working in healthcare, education, service providers, some of which are renters by choice. And we tend to, you know, we want to be very close to employment and entertainment hubs. We buy an underpositioned asset and then bring it up to its potential where people feel proud to live there. And there's a stickiness for those, whether they're renters, you know, there's plenty of other options in many markets, or, you know, maybe they are looking at a home, but they're happy with where they're living. And then, you know, maybe they put that purchase off for a little bit, just wait to see what happens. Right. Mm-hmm. So we tend to do a design focused renovation that looks a little different than kind of the standard that everybody else is doing. And it tends to have the same finishes as an A-class high rise, perhaps even down the street. It's just several hundred dollars or more less a month to the renter. So I think the other potential opportunity that's coming up, and it depends on what happens with all these maturing loans and how the banks handle it and their ability to be forgiving, is to buy some really high quality assets, way below replacement cost, that may be a lighter value add, or there's a value add component, but perhaps we're stepping up into the B plus A minus class given opportunities. But we'll see what makes its way to market.
I guess that's the 2024 burning question, right? Is how are the banks going to handle the loan maturities? What's going to happen with, you know, the owners that are faced with having to pay the piper in some way, shape, or form? And it's, I've heard a variety of different opinions on this. Let's go to the extreme. Let's say that the banks handle it, I guess, in a way in which buyers would be the beneficiaries. What's the game plan there, right? Like, how are you approaching that? Are you going straight to the banks? You have relationships, obviously, with some banks. How are you going to navigate that to put yourself in the best position to get these deals?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. It's definitely going to the lenders, but it's also going to sellers that we think may have an issue achieving a refinance without having to put equity in. So we're kind of hitting it from both ends, and how we're sourcing that is also a mixed bag. It's through our existing relationships with lenders, servicers, other sponsors, perhaps investors that have told us there's some distressed assets out there, or the sponsors themselves. We're also leveraging online databases to identify loans coming due that are not within the next, call it 12 months, that are not achieving a 1.0 debt service coverage ratio. That's going to be, that's looking at a cash in refi at best, or it could be looking at a bank taking it back. I guess the best case scenario would actually be that the bank works with them if they're getting close and they see a path to profitability or neutrality. It seems that the banks don't really want a ton of these assets. They don't want to take them back like they did the last cycle. So what we've seen so far has been a very cooperative nature, and it's prevented further value erosion. There has been value erosion simply from interest rates blowing out so quickly and cap rates following suit. But, you know, the next big threat to valuations would be if there is a big wave of deals taken back, and at that point everybody's buying at the loan balance or perhaps below that. And that's another, if you think about it, it's a 20-25% plus discount from what a sponsor bought it for. And then if it's below the loan amount, that's a significant discount that those are now the new comps, right? So it's bringing prices back down.
Yep.
I can think of a couple assets that we've been watching that have been taken back by banks, and the banks are upside down by 5 million plus.
Really?
And they're trying to solve it for themselves, but I'm just not sure that those are, that they're up for the task. It's going to take quite some time, and I don't know how much time they have. So, you know, we're waiting in the wings saying, hi, we're still here. We're the right buyer for you. You know us. this is our bread and butter, and we'd love to take it off your hands, but it's got to be at the right price.
Sure. There's been a lot of speculation. I mean, this whole last year, you know, I kept saying it. It's like almost every week. It's like the next 18 to 24 months, the next 18 to 24 months, the next 18 to 24 months. That was 6 months ago. And it still feels like I'm saying the next 18 to 24 months. So it just feels like we're just delaying the inevitable. Are we?
Very well could be. Or, you know, there's two scenarios I was thinking of that fixes this. One is, if given enough time, then the values do catch up with these aggressive underwriting, but it's going to take more time, years. The other is a wave of foreclosures that resets values. I mean, pricing got very frothy when money was free. And how do you justify, you know, $300,000 plus for a 60s vintage asset in Salt Lake or in Atlanta? Yeah. You know, those just, it's just not the pricing of them current day or even. So I think those are the two scenarios for getting back to a market at equilibrium where we can transact in a normal, normal pace.
So. Yeah, no, I think it's going to be super fascinating to see what happens, man. I mean, look, I'm kind of preparing for any of the above. Look, at the end of the day, like all this could blow over. We could end up just in 2 years having never really truly experienced like any sort of like major commercial crash or correction. I feel like it's already been happening. You know, if you read the TREP reports and everything, you start to see like there are, you know, a lot more people, you know, going into special servicing. There's a lot more defaults and everything that are happening right now. So it's happening. The question is, as to your points, like how are the banks going to handle it? And I think that that's kind of like the $1 million question, because you're right. No one wants to like foreclose on a bunch of these. I mean, that's just going to ruin them. Right. That's going to ruin the bank. So it will be interesting to see how everything shakes out. And I guess it'll be a fun ride. However.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that you got me thinking where you said by 2025, 2026, maybe this all passes without calamity. Mm-hmm. And I honestly think, call it late 25, 26, 27, I think there's a great opportunity for appreciation again. And the reason for that is we were already short in housing, right? There's been a big wave the last couple of years that got financed a couple of years ago when land was cheaper, construction costs were cheaper, materials were cheaper, and interest rates were lower. That, for the most part, there are very few development deals that are getting done now. And so the wave of supply that is holding back rents and values will have pretty much delivered and been absorbed by renters by the end of 25, 26. And so I see an uptick in demand again. I see concessions probably going away or being drastically reduced. Sure. And I think you get back to, you know, a good period for landlords where there's value creation, there's rent appreciation, et cetera.
What do you have to say to the people that say multifamily is oversaturated?
I think it is in certain ways and in certain markets. I think a lot of A-class has been built in desirable Sunbelt markets. And I think it's going to take a little while for those to be absorbed. But I think they will. They're growing markets because there's jobs, there's higher education, there's an appealing lifestyle, there's a lower cost of living. So it's just this giant wave of supply that's making it look saturated. And, you know, time will take care of that as more and more people move to, you know, a Phoenix and Nashville and Austin and Atlanta.
You touched on something right now that I think is worth like re-exploring. And it's funny because like everyone says now is a horrible time to build. And I've been doing a lot of like deep, like thought about this, like a, like just brain exercise. Wouldn't now be the best time to start developing property?
I think so, because you're not going to have a lot of new A-class product that you're competing against in 26 or 27. Now is a difficult time to build. And what I mean by that, it's difficult to get a project financed and off the ground or shovels in the ground. But yeah, there's a lot of people that there's a whole strategy of building into either a recession or, you know, a downtime in construction. And there's a lot of favorable variables that come with that. To circle back on your question about, is the multifamily space saturated? I touched on it. It's A-class. That's all you can build. It's very difficult to build workforce housing. So what you're really doing, it's a competitive space, but what you're doing is, in order to create workforce housing, you're just waiting for newer product to age to a point that it now becomes affordable for many. So I think there's plenty of demand in the C and B space, particularly B, you know, because B is a little more quality renter, quality housing. It's just not your either brand new wrap product or high rise product that's highly amenitized. You still have amenities. They're just perhaps older and need a refresh, or perhaps they've recently been refreshed, but they're still at a discount to the A-class.
Yeah, because, you know, as I was, you know, just kind of putting a bow on this conversation here, I, as you might know, might not know, I focus on the hotel sector, and, you know, there's so, like, everyone's don't build. And I'm like, hold on a second. Everyone's saying don't build. So I'm thinking now should be the time to build, because if we build now, then that means we should be up and running by 26, 27. And at that point, we'll have an entire cycle. You get to ride the asset one entire, like a brand new asset for an entire cycle. And I was like, that seems pretty lucrative if you can get the financing in order and if you can, as you said, get it off the ground, because that's obviously the most difficult part right now. But it's a, it's an interesting thought. And you know, even just talking with you now, I'm like, wow, that seems like almost painfully, like too obvious. It's like painfully obvious, but like, I think the financing is the biggest hurdle for people right now. In trying to, you know, turn that into a reality.
Yeah, that and equity is equally cautious as well. Yeah. So, you know, if you have great equity relationships, then perhaps you can get that done. I think it's the really established sponsors that have the relationships with lenders and equity that that will be able to build during this time, and they will reap the benefits of it. I always say to our investors is I look at this period as we are catching the wave as it crashes and investing now and going forward for the next couple of years is allowing us to kind of ride that wave back up the next cycle. And so whether that's through development or buying existing assets, you know, you still have to buy at the right basis, but that's where I think we are.
I want to go back to your hands-on management, right? Because we talked about conservative underwriting, hands-on management. What does that mean, right? In terms of like, like daily operational habits and tendencies? Yeah.
We, the principals at Stonemark Landing, we have two weekly calls with our site level teams. One is related to overall operations, challenges they're seeing, how are we doing with turning units, where are we with staffing, are we having any issues with delinquency, et cetera. It also creates a relationship with our site level staff. And we always tell them, like the property manager, hey, you're the CEO of a multi-million dollar asset and treat it as such. You're the leader here.
Yeah.
You're leading a team. And you know, your property manager and your maintenance supervisor, they drive a lot of value for an apartment asset. You can have an exceptional buy, but if you have a subpar team, that asset quickly follows suit. So, you know, we do that. We also have a weekly pricing call where we're talking with our property manager and leasing team, as well as the pricing team, where we're understanding our comps. We're understanding where which way is pricing going? Are there concessions creeping in the market? What's overall market occupancy? And what does this tool say to do with pricing? And we're not just blindly following that tool. We're following our own intuition. We're taking cues from our site level team who's giving us feedback on what they're seeing in the market, what prospects are saying as it relates to pricing or concessions or perhaps the product as a whole and things that could be improved. And we take action with that. You know, the other thing I think with hands-on management is there's a lot of metrics that can tell you if the business plan is working, like your return on renovation. Do you need to tweak it because you're not hitting the ROI that you thought you would in your pro forma? Or could we still hit that ROI, but by, you know, maybe we don't need a certain feature that costs more. There's a more cost-effective way of doing that. That maybe it just wasn't valued in the market and you don't need to spend that money to get that rent. It will also tell you if you have the right team in place. Are turns happening within the prescribed time frame? How quickly are you turning renovation units? Do those units look presentable when prospects come through? What is your lead to lease ratio? So you're spending all this money marketing. Is it hitting the right target market? Or is the market not getting what they expected from what they saw online when they meet the on-site team or when they see the product? Is it not clean? You know, there's a lot of things that can tell you from afar if things are working well or if they're not. And those are the things that we focus on to ensure that our assets are running smoothly.
Makes a lot of sense. And one thing that I want to highlight there, you know, the bi-weekly calls to on-site staff, you know, it's funny how like tiny hinges, like Coach O says, it's tiny hinges swing big doors. You know, it's like this, like the simple things that kind of, you know, create the most return. And I would have to imagine that even that consistent presence just keeps everyone on task, right? Like if the absent owner is gonna, you know, if you do a once a month kind of call, like they're gonna show up once a month, right? But if you're showing up every week, twice a week, like it keeps the train moving. I would have to imagine.
Yeah, that's right. And having regular site visits where, you know, sometimes people have been there a long time, they turn a blind eye to certain things. And so you're saying, oh, what, now what's going on with this? Dead plant material in the planters, or the, you know, when's the last time the grass was cut? Are we on top of our landscaper? One of the most recent acquisition we bought, be it 14, 16 months ago, those were the opportunities that we saw. They were operational opportunities because the presentation that if I showed up as a prospective renter, I would immediately think that this place is run down and it isn't warranted for the price that they were asking. And those are the things that we love to buy, the assets, the deals that are underpositioned, and it doesn't take a huge investment in some of those things to move the needle. It's just paying attention and holding teams accountable. Yep. Also training your team to look through your eyes and explaining to them how saving $2,000 a month, how that affects the value. You know, a lot of times site teams, property managers aren't necessarily aware as to how a $24,000 a year savings at a six cap affects your overall value. And it's eye-opening to them. And they're going, wow, I can really affect value here. So
interesting.
I think there's just a lot of collaboration that can be done to ensure success?
That's a really good point. And actually, I think for anyone who's, you know, either a sponsor, GP, or you just manage your own properties, like, I think that is a really great nugget there that you kind of tuck away. It's interesting, you know, one of my business coaches encouraged me to open up my P&L to my employees, because for years I like literally would just kind of, you know, the kimono, right? Like, no one could see underneath the kimono. It's weird what happens,
right,
when you let people see inside the kimono, because all of a sudden you can have more transparent conversations with them. You can keep it real.
That's right.
And when you can keep it real, and then also point to things in the P&L, like, hey, this is what, you know, you influence this, 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 and this, and that's what impacts our bottom line, whether it be on, you know, on the revenue side of things or on the expense side of things. The truth is that a lot of these people, you know, a lot of employees, we know, but they don't know. And if we don't tell them, so that makes a lot of sense to me, man. That makes a lot of sense to me. And I think that's smart.
Yeah. Well, it also aligns you as to the why, right? It's not just do it because I say so. It's do it because this is why. This is how we extract value. This is why NOI is so important. This is why we tie your bonus to NOI. Sure. It's not just being, you know, a greedy landlord, as some people like to label landlords. This is how you affect value for your investors.
100%.
And when your bonus is tied to NOI, it affects value for yourself too.
Yeah. So. Well, also, I think like an added thing there that might not be so obvious to people is that, you know, when you're running, whether it be a multifamily or, you know, hotels or whatever you're running, and you have employees that are directly responsible for the management and for the you know, the operation of the asset, it's like, if you do a good job, you're not just, you know, if you do a good job as a leader, you're actually not just like helping them understand like how they're driving revenue or how they're driving like the value of the property. You're also teaching them like basic business principles that maybe a lot of them don't like have no awareness of beforehand, you know? And like that translates, like, I would imagine, I don't know, I'm just like spitballing with you here, Cameron, but like, I would imagine that like some of your people have gone off and like, you know, bought their own investment properties and things like that, probably because of the hands-on, like direct mentorship that you gave them that like got them to understand and think about things in a different way.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the best compliment, right? Is that you've actually been able to launch somebody else's career different than they thought they were doing, or maybe they wanted to, but you were able to contribute to their success and their growth as a professional and potentially a person as well.
I love that. And on that same topic, you know, let's talk about, you know, people that kind of transitioning into investing or people that want to get involved and have not done it before. How would you recommend that someone get their start, you know, if they're newer to real estate investing in general? What would your recommendation be?
I would consume all information you can. And there is so much information now, whether that's podcasts like this, courses on YouTube, as far as, you know, how do you underwrite a deal? How do you evaluate that? What are valuations? I would read investment books. I would go to meetups. I would find mentors in the space that of where I want to be and ask them if I could buy them lunch. And before you step into investing, I think you really need to understand what you're getting into and be able to ask the right questions. I think you want to be able to, whether you're the sponsor or just an LP, I think you've got to be able to underwrite the deal yourself and understand it. Do these rent comps make sense? Do the sales comps make sense? Not just the sales comp at acquisition, but where are we trying to get to? Are there comps that support that? So I think, you know, education is key. And then taking action. You cannot wait for the right time, because there's never the right time. It is never convenient to start a business or start investing on your own. It's just either you want to do it or you don't. I can tell you, I wish I figured out how to get it done sooner. I certainly tried to. You know, like I said, I was pushing that boulder up a hill to get my first deal done. But there are great benefits to being a real estate investor. From a professional standpoint, from a tax benefit standpoint, and from just the freedom within your personal life and flexibility.
You have investments all over the U.S. Yeah.
Yes. Well, we have. We've invested from the East Coast to the West Coast out to Las Vegas. Our current holdings are in Atlanta and Charleston.
Okay.
So we recently got sold a number of our assets in kind of preparation for potential opportunity. And that not only freed up capital, but it also freed up our time to focus on the acquisitions of new great assets.
Love it. Thinking ahead. I love it. If you're a new investor, if you were a new investor, where would you invest today? Would it be Atlanta? Would it be Charleston? Or would it be somewhere else?
You know, I think you have to invest in a market that you understand. So maybe that's geographically, or maybe you've taken the time to research a market that you perhaps don't live in, but you like, you know, all the metrics that make sense for you, right? But Sunbelt, both Atlanta and Charleston are great markets to be in. I would tell you, you need to understand processes there too. For example, in a couple metro counties that make up kind of in-town Atlanta, Fulton and DeKalb, it's really difficult to evict right now. I mean, you're talking 12 months plus, not because of a change in law, but just because of how backed up these courts are. And so you have to approach a deal with caution, knowing that bad debt is not going to get that much better because these tenants know it as well. On the flip side, if you go to Charleston, somebody doesn't pay rent, it takes 30, 45 days, right? So that's one metric that can significantly impact the value of your asset, particularly if you're doing a value add where you're starting to non-renew older tenants the previous tenants where, you know, maybe legacy tenants that may not fit the profile for the next refinance or for the next positioning of an asset, right? Like they're not going to be able to afford it. Or perhaps their behaviors on site are also not going to fit where you're going with that asset. And that's the reality for some of the assets that we buy. So, and that's part of our repositioning. But if you can't get bad actors out, that's going to slow down your entire process. And it could become a challenge because you could get some sort of rent strike like you see in some of these other in some Western markets, like in California.
What are you trying to say, Cameron? No,
I think it's a market knowledge thing and a comfortability, but I do think investing in Sunbelt and Mountain West markets where you have positive in-migration driven by job growth and quality of life, also affordability, that's a great start. A lot of people are finding yield in the Midwest, and maybe you don't get those huge swings from wild rent increases or cap rate compression, but it is steady and predictable. We're not in Midwestern markets. We focus on Sunbelt and Mountain West, but you know, I've talked to a lot of people with that strategy and they like it, the Midwest, for that reason. And it makes sense.
Yeah, the kind of add to that. I mean, whenever anyone asks me, like, where do you want to buy your hotels? And I said, anywhere but California. Just like, put me anywhere except for California. And, you know, politics aside, it's just to your point, right? Like, landlord friendly policies are essential if you're going to be investing in real estate, like, you know, significant amounts of real estate. If a primary residence that you turn into an investment property, all right, whatever, like, go live your life. But I think it's a very real social issue that we're going to be faced with over the next decade plus, maybe, of how do we strike this balance where, you know, like you said before, like landlords are like, how do we like rid ourselves of like this, like, we're like demons and we're bad people and everything. It's just like, okay, well, Without us, how, you know, how else? Anyways, we're not even gonna go down that road, Cameron.
Yeah,
that's the
that's the non-published sure.
version of this podcast, buddy.
That's exactly.
Oh man, you talked about equity being hard to come by nowadays. I'm curious, you know, when you were getting started, I'm sure on the come up, equity was also hard to come by. And for different reasons, obviously. So when you're just getting started, you know, it's hard to get people to investors to trust you. How did you, you said the first couple of deals you did with like one, two investors. So how did you overcome those initial hurdles and what were the strategies that you used to get investors to believe in Cameron Pym?
Yeah, you know, I was kind of sharing our successes with our friends, family, our network, colleagues, yep. et cetera. And then once we started getting more and more investors, we treated them like gold. You have a question? Please call me anytime. Call me on the weekend. I love to talk shop. So anytime you want to talk about it, I'm happy to pick up the phone. You know, I think it's having regular communication, monthly updates as to where you are, showing the progress if you're doing renovations, photo progress, having more robust quarterly updates. But a lot of it is communication and building trust. And a willingness to listen and answer questions. I mean, I've had people approach me to invest, and it's scary when it's not in my control, right? And I do that plenty of times, but it's a really nice reminder for me that this may not be every day for somebody, and it's a big step to write somebody a check, whether that's $25,000 or $1 million, right? That's, they're putting a lot of trust in you. So I think you need to always remember that somebody has believed in you. They're investing just as much in you as they're investing in the asset.
Yeah.
And that's true for retail investors, like a friend or a family member. And it's also true for private equity firms. They want to see your track record, who you are. They want to talk to you. They want to understand if, not if, but when something doesn't go to plan, are you the type of person that can solve it? Do you have the experience? Do you have the mentality to do that? And they're right to do that.
When you're having those initial conversations, because obviously like at first, well, let's back up for a second. So from what I'm hearing or for what I'm gathering is that you had done a certain amount of deals before you went out and looked for investors, correct?
We looked for investors from the start. We just didn't have many. Yeah. you know, we were young, didn't have much of our own capital, but we had... you know, we certainly had plenty of sweat equity to offer. And since then, you know, we've grown and we always invest alongside our investors. So if it hurts for us, if it hurts for our investors, it's going to hurt for us too. But, you know, now it's investing alongside them. And now the challenge is it's not so much finding the investors anymore. I think there's plenty of dry powder on the sidelines. With private equity and family offices, it's finding the right deals now because now those are few and far between.
Yeah, that's true. When there's plenty of deals, not a lot of capital. When there's not a lot of capital, there's plenty of deals. Makes sense. So just a quick side note here, a question is, are you primarily running a fund model now? At your firm, or is it now more, or are you doing like more syndicated deals versus fund? Like how do you structure your deals?
Yeah, we raised a co-GP fund to kind of keep our retail investors involved with us and growing with us. It also allows us to scale up if there's a huge wave of opportunities that come up due to debt maturities, like we had been talking about. And then we're going to pair that with family office private equity in the LP position.
Gotcha.
And what we realized, you know, we had the realization at NMHC, the start of 2023, is there's a lot of money on the sidelines waiting for the right opportunity. So how do we scale up and be prepared to take advantage of that? Because being a sponsor is also expensive. You know, we're investing alongside... In the co-GP fund, we have our own money in there. We'll also have our own money if we do a deal outside of that fund too. So we're really looking at two different vehicles. So it'd be one-off deals where it's just the GPs within our group, and then the other one that'll fit within that fund, that co-GP fund structure, fit the parameters of those.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I haven't heard of a lot of people doing that, but I think that's a great way to kind of involve everyone that you now have access to. Because yeah, you know, like I think one of the things that, one of the challenges that I'm sure that you ran into at some point was like, man, these deals are so big that like the guys that got us here really aren't going to get us there. Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's a way to keep them investing with somebody that they know and trust.
I like that.
And I wouldn't want to outgrow them.
Yeah.
Right.
That's brilliant, man. I really like that idea. And it's actually something that I had been thinking about too, is like, hey, like when this happens, right? How are you going to keep people involved? That's actually a really awesome idea. So that's great.
Well, if you ever need a roadmap for that, feel free to call me. We've done the brain damage on it. So happy to be
appreciate
a resource.
Appreciate that, brother. Appreciate that. You know, we're coming up on time here, so I want to make sure that we touch on some a couple of, you know, last minute points here. Correct me if I'm wrong. I could be totally off base here, but I recall you saying on a podcast, or remember hearing you on a podcast saying that you target properties that you can buy at a 20% discount. Am I wrong, or is that something that you said?
We certainly do that, but we also look for rents to be about the in-place rents to be 20% discount to where we think we can get our renovated rents.
Okay.
In addition to that, in our working class achievable model, we're looking to get those renovated or stabilized rents. We're very mindful of what the median household income is for the area. And so we want it to be within what the realm of just general financial planning affordability is. So rent should, your cost of housing should not exceed 30% of your household income. So we're mindful about that our rent's in there, and that they're also at a 25% discount to what a monthly mortgage cost would be. And so that's proven to be robust for us, where there's plenty of demand and we're getting quality tenants, and there's a stickiness to it.
Yeah, that's great. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because you're baking in the upside by making sure like, hey, like, you're baking in the returns by making sure that there's enough upside on the deal. So that makes a lot of sense to me. And how have you sourced these deals in the past? You know, like maybe the last few years have been difficult, but like before that, how are you sourcing these types of deals?
Real estate is a contact sport. And what I mean by that is you need to be contacting your network, and that's local brokers, local sponsors, property management companies, investors, lenders. You never know where somebody's going to find a deal for you. You know, hey, this guy's looking at selling it, wants to move off of it quickly. You know, we've also leveraged online platforms. You mentioned TREP earlier. We're identifying those that probably need to sell before their debt comes due, or are seriously considering it right now. They're staring it down because the debt service coverage ratio is below one, or they have a rate cap expiring, which is going to be very expensive. So it's all of that.
Yeah, it makes sense. And yeah, I mean, like it's funny. I was at a hotel conference earlier this week, and I was talking to one of the brokers, and she's doing a lot of deals. And I asked her, I was like, hey, like, how are you finding these deals? And she's like, literally like just cold calling all day. And I was like, you guys still do that? Like, it's 2024, dude. You still cold call, but yeah, she's like, yeah, of course. Like, how else are you going to build a relationship? Makes sense.
Yeah.
You know? Makes sense.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how you get directly to the source. Or if somebody's on the fence, like, right. There you go.
Right. So. And is another interesting thought there too, is like, at least for her, is, hey, the sellers are buyers too. So, you know, there's always multiple ways to look at it. And I think that's...
She's dialing for dollars.
She sure is.
And that's working.
She sure is. So what are your plans for 2024? What are you seeing in the market right now, Cam? And what are your plans to take advantage of the opportunities that 24 presents?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a renewed optimism, whether that's some of these maturities come on, maybe there's some rate cuts, maybe people are ready to transact because that bid-ask spread has compressed. But I think I'm not alone in saying this, that there's a more optimism this year that some more deals will get done. I think people are looking towards the second half of the year for that to happen, just to see how things play out. And also that's when a lot of debt maturities from the first wave of cheap money come up. So we're constantly looking for the right deals. And you know, we're fortunate that we are not in any bad deals where we're trying to plug holes right now. So we can really focus on our acquisition strategy, finding the right deals, you know, building the right relationships to get those done.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. And it's interesting to hear you say that, like, you know, the second half of this year, I'm just, you know, playing devil's advocate here. It's an election year. And typically, you know, second half of the year, we start to see people pump the brakes on everything because they don't know what's going on. So, how do you see that playing into the mix? You know, with like politics aside, right? Like, how do you see all that playing into the mix?
Yeah, that could certainly throw a wrench into things. And I had have a buddy who kind of gave him the same spiel, and that was his response but there's an election.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, you know, I guess we just keep turning over stones and hope that we find something great within it. If not, you know, we'll be patient. So you don't ever want to be stuck in a bad deal. And I think that's very important to remember. As antsy as we may get, I'm a deal guy, so I've been a little bit bored with the lack of activity going on. But, you know, it's been a great opportunity to be a good father and husband. So I have some more time to spend at home.
Hey, man, so. I love that. I love that. So, well, in traditional goldmine fashion, Cameron, let's have you lead the audience with one final gold nugget.
Yeah, it's along the lines of what I just said. The best deal is the bad deal you didn't do.
Oof, that's a good one. Mic drop.
Yeah.
Mic drop. I love that, man.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, gosh. Well, hey, it's been a pleasure, Cameron. Lots of really insightful information that you shared. So thanks so much for stopping by. And next time I'm in Vegas, I'm going to stop by and see you.
Please do. Thank you for having me.
Take care.